18-15336 Orlando Estrada versus FTS US LLC. And Mr. Zeidel.
Yes, good morning. Jay Zeidel on behalf of myself and my law firm. Rule 11 is intended to deter claims with no factual or legal basis at all. Creative claims coupled even with ambiguous or inconsequential facts may merit dismissal, but not punishment. We appeal the district court's imposition of Rule 11 sanctions.
So you say that Rule 11 is designed to sanction, deter, punish allegations, factual allegations that have no basis. Is there any factual basis for the never paid allegation in the complaint?
Yes, there is.
Tell me about it.
There is, because this case dealt with a piece rate. Under the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that's at CFR 29, CFR 778.12. That's an all or nothing system. The employer has to have certain variables 100% correct in order to deviate from the normal payment of overtime under that provision. One of those variables is the amount of weekly hours that the employee works. If that variable is off, the whole system fails, and therefore, our contention from the very beginning of this case was that the plaintiff, or in this case, was never paid overtime because he claimed that hours were constantly shaved off of his time in the morning before the shift, after the shift, and otherwise. We conducted a detailed client interview. We filed the complaint as overtime never having been paid pursuant to the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's in our complaint. And under Rule 8, we felt that met the liberal pleading requirements of that rule. There is no requirement to specify the CFR, nor is there any reason or applicable regulation that would require us to specify more than that.
Mr. Zeidel, when you saw that this was going south with the district court, why did you not just amend the complaint to address what appeared to be deficiencies in the factual support that the magistrate judge through the R&Rs was finding?
Well, Judge Hall, the defendant waited until discovery was over, until the amendment deadline had passed. We were at the summary judgment phase of this case, and they sent the Rule 11 letter out after all of those deadlines had had passed already. So when we got the Rule 11 letter, and which was a draft of their motion, basically, it was alleging everything. It was just saying the case is frivolous. We did not know specifically that they were complaining about paragraph 13. I don't even know if they did until we filed our response. They filed the reply and underscored paragraph 13 says never paid overtime. Well, had they brought that to our attention at the very beginning of the case when they knew about this clearly, because they had the plaintiff's records, they had the plaintiff's employee file where he signed that he acknowledged that he knew how the system was being paid to him. They had all of that information at the very beginning of the case, but they waited until after all of those deadlines had expired, and there was nothing we could do, especially with this particular district judge. I can tell you that I felt at that time, and I still do, we would have had no chance at the summary judgment stage to say that we had good cause to amend the complaint beyond the scheduling order deadlines, because good faith would have required diligence and to show that we didn't have the records, which we did by that time. Everybody had the records because we had those produced to us as part of the defendant's answer to our statement of claim at the very beginning of the case. So everybody knew that this piece rate system was being used. The defendants even said in their initial pleading, the response to the statement of claim, we defend this case based on CFR 778.12. So they knew all of this. They just waited until all of those deadlines lapsed, and we could do nothing except for defend on the original complaint, which we felt still met the liberal pleading requirements of Rule 8.
But of course, like though, one of the things that either the magistrate judge or the district judge said, I forget which one right now, was that you purportedly should have taken corrective action once Mr. Estrada's deposition was taken, because at that point he conceded, although he later apparently tried to walk some of it back, he conceded that he had been paid at least some overtime wages as shown by the defendant's wage and hour records. Did they have any basis for saying that, or you think that was incorrect too?
Well, that's the same position that I just responded to Judge Hall. At the time the plaintiff's deposition was taken, remember, this was a case where two depositions occurred, the plaintiff's deposition and the defendant's. No written discovery was exchanged between the parties at all in the underlying case. They waited until the very end of discovery, I believe the last week of discovery, way past the amendment deadline to depose the plaintiff. He said, he went back and forth, but his contention was that, yes, the pay stubs show some overtime being paid, but he denies that he ever received overtime paid to him properly under this piece rate system, because they were shaving off hours from his time constantly. That was his position. He filed an affidavit. The district judge never struck his affidavit, never determined that his affidavit was a sham or anything like that. That was his position. And we, you know, we just feel that this magistrate bent over backwards to resolve every doubt against us when she shouldn't have done that in a Rule 11 context. We're supposed to get the benefit if there was a doubt. Everybody knew that this was about the piece rate system. There are times, and this court has consistently held, that the purpose of Rule 11 is to give the other side a chance to correct it. In this case, that chance was taken away, even though it's kind of a two-sided argument, because we feel that the initial pleading under Rule 8 was proper when we said, as per the Fair Labor Standards Act. Was it inartful? Perhaps. Could we have stated it better in hindsight? Yes. But the district court is not supposed to be looking at in hindsight when it assesses Rule 11. They're supposed to be looking at what happened at the time that that pleading was filed. Now,
if we agree with the district court that in fact the claim was objectively frivolous, how can you then argue that relying solely on a client interview without looking at pay records is a reasonable inquiry pre-suit?
Well, I don't know that the district court found the whole case to be frivolous, and I don't think it did.
No, they found that claim, obviously, under paragraph 13. That's where the basis for this finding was. And so if, in fact, they were correct, how do you then argue that your actions pre-suit were reasonable?
Well, Judge Hall, when we got these records from the defendant, it was at the very beginning of the case. The plaintiff still disavowed that he had received all of his compensation, because he claimed that they constantly shaved time off. So it's unclear how we would have changed anything had we sent a pre-suit letter out to the defendants saying, give us all of his time records, when the plaintiff was disavowing the accuracy of those to begin with.
Mr. Estrada's position was that those records said what they said, but they were inaccurate.
That's correct.
What did he admit to about the records, if anything, at his deposition?
He said that he admitted receiving the pay. The defendants knew that because it was a direct pay deposit into his account. He wasn't given paychecks. So they knew that he received all the pay. He acknowledged that he received the pay. He said that the pay stubs say what they say, but that since it was direct pay, he didn't have access to that before the case. And that's it. I mean, his position was always that he was cheated out of hours, and our position on his behalf was, under CFR 778.12, that means that no overtime was paid. The magistrate she found that our statement of claim was not frivolous. She said on this record, she can't determine that the whole case is frivolous, and that's document 78. So we don't it's just an inconsistent position for Rule 11 to say that that one allegation of the complaint could have been phrased better, should have been phrased better, but the whole case was not found to be frivolous, and yet she somehow unearths a $60,000 sanction based on defendant's records that she even admits and her report and recommendation that she has an extremely hard time sifting through, because when they sent the Rule 11 motion, they were claiming sanctions under the Florida statute that the magistrate found completely meritless and disappointing that they would move for sanctions and at the same time cite to a statute that has no applicability whatsoever, billing records that made no sense whatsoever. And these statutes are supposed to be construed narrowly. These are sanctioned statutes. These chill people's rights, attorneys' rights. And we think that the magistrate abused her discretion and asked for a reversal.
Thank you very much. You've saved your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Crisman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. John Crisman on behalf of Appellee FTS USA LLC. We are here today to argue in support under the broad abuse of discretion standard that the district court had here, both the magistrate judge and the district judge, in affirming the imposition of Rule 11 sanctions against counsel because of the broad discretion that the court has. The court found here, Mr. Zeidel spoke of the one allegation in the complaint. That one allegation was the only claim that was asserted within the complaint, that the plaintiff was, quote, never paid any overtime. That was the claim that the district court found when summary judgment was resolved to have been the only.
They could have prevailed on that claim had the facts borne out, even if that allegation wasn't completely accurate. In other words, if you had denied him 90% of his overtime wages, the complaint would not have been objectively frivolous, right?
The complaint would have been objectively frivolous because the allegation was that he was never paid any overtime.
Okay, Mr. Crisman, if a plaintiff does not prevail on two of four claims because the facts don't bear out the losing two claims, does that mean at the end of the day that those claims were objectively frivolous?
No, Your Honor.
So you can't use the mere fact that you got summary judgment in your favor as a ground for a Rule 11 award, right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
There has to be more than that.
Certainly, Your Honor. The mere granting of summary judgment does not mean the side that loses is then subject to a Rule 11 violation here.
All right, let me take you down a set of questions. And I know we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard. And that may, at the end of the day, help you substantially. But if Mr. Estrada provided sworn testimony that your client's billing wage and hour records were inaccurate, how did you get summary judgment in your favor?
We got summary judgment in our favor because the claim that was asserted, the court found, based on the testimony and the facts that were presented, that the undisputed facts of those records were that the timesheets were presented as they were. That was his time. The earning statements equaled the timesheets. And so there was no dispute that he was.
There is a dispute.
Paid.
There is a dispute.
You're telling
me that there is never a case when an employer's wage and hour records are incorrect or have been falsified.
There are a ton of cases out there with that allegation, Your Honor.
I am asking you whether or not you can imagine a case where an employer's wage and hour records are not accurate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If you admit of that possibility and an employee says, listen, they've been shorting me 2 hours every single week. I know what the pay records say, but I've been working 42 hours a week and they're logging 40 hours every single week. Do you get summary judgment for the employer?
Under that hypothetical, no, Your Honor.
Okay, what was the difference here?
The difference here was that the claim was that he was never paid any overtime.
But you can win on that. That claim subsumes the claim that you weren't paid some overtime, right? It necessarily subsumes. If the district court had found that you did indeed pay him 10% of the overtime that he was entitled to, but denied him 90% of the overtime that he was entitled to, do you get summary judgment in your favor?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so the claim of never subsumes a claim of sometimes, right?
The claim of never
subsumes a claim of sometimes, right? In other words, 100% of his claim may not have been provable, but if he proves 70% of his claim, he can recover on 70% of his claim, right?
He could potentially, if that was the claim that was asserted. I think
what
I would argue.
Asserted?
I think I would argue in response to the claim of never. The cases that I've seen.
So the district court said, oh, they denied you some overtime, but because you claimed they never gave you overtime, you lose. Was that the district court's rationale?
No, that was not the district.
What was the district court's rationale?
District court's rationale was that the veracity and the accuracy of the payroll records and the time records lined up and matched up, and there was no other claim other than the single claim that he was never paid any overtime.
How can you grant summary judgment when the employee provides sworn testimony that those records are inaccurate?
The testimony that was provided at the deposition, that's not how the district court read the record and the facts.
Did he deny that the records were accurate?
Portions of his testimony were vague and nondescript. And then the plaintiff submitted an affidavit in response to the motion for summary judgment. And the affidavit was freewheeling and shapeless. And we argued at that point that the affidavit was being submitted in order to contravene and contradict the undisputed deposition testimony that had been presented. In response to all of that submissions, the district court resolved that there was no factual dispute here as to his time and pay records as to the claim that was presented and sitting before the court. One FLSA claimed that he was never paid any overtime wages, and in fact, he was. The claim that he was never, there are cases certainly out there where the allegation of somebody never being paid overtime, those would be the instances in which somebody was designated as an exempt employee from the FLSA overtime laws, in which they would have been paid a salary and thus never paid any overtime wages. Plaintiff's counsel was presented with the pay records 6 weeks after the complaint was filed, showing that in fact his client was paid overtime wages, in fact significant overtime wages in more than half of his weeks and more than $10,000, and there was no simple, basic pre-suit inquiry that had been conducted and no attempts made to either withdraw the complaint as it was pled, to amend the complaint as it was pled at any course of the litigation, even up through now, through this appeal. Counsel has really stated that he doesn't see a problem in the initial complaint despite all that the district court has found and despite the prior ruling of this court affirming those summary judgment.
I'll ask you one more question and then I'll let my colleagues jump in if they want. When you move for sanctions in part under a Florida statute, right?
We did, Your Honor.
That was an objectively frivolous claim, right?
That was
because a Florida statute on sanctions cannot apply, does not apply, in a federal action based on federal question jurisdiction, right?
It does not apply, Your Honor, and the district court took that into account.
Would you have been sanctioned for making that objectively frivolous claim and making Mr. Zeidel and his firm respond to it?
Would we have been sanctioned?
Could you have been sanctioned? Should you have been sanctioned?
No, Your Honor, the process that would have...
What case law gave you any inkling of hope that a district court could apply that Florida statute in a federal question case under the FLSA?
That was not properly included in the motion for sanctions and the process
that's not
that would've...
That's not my question to you. My question to you is...
It was an improper reading of the statute, Your Honor.
It's not an improper reading. It's a frivolous reading of the statute. Should you have been sanctioned for that?
No, Your Honor.
No, why?
Because
you made a claim that had no basis in law, right?
And the Rule 11...
Mr. Zeidel respond to it.
What Mr. Zeidel could have done at that moment in response to that pleading was to send a safe harbor motion on FTS, which was not served on the
basis
of that.
You got lucky. You should wield that Rule 11 cudgel with caution, Mr. Christman, because there's going to come a time when it's going to come around and whack you in the back of the head. And maybe you got lucky this time. And maybe you win on appeal because of the abuse of discretion standard. But if you're playing the what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and I speak only for myself and not for my colleagues, it doesn't quite sit right. So I've said my piece.
Understood, Your Honor. Rule 11 is a serious charge to bring and not one that's brought lightly. And that does explain the timing of FTS bringing the Rule 11 motion when it did. This case lingered for a long time on the district court's docket, in part due to a bankruptcy proceeding involving FTS. So it was stayed for more than a year. I think the way to look at the timing of the motion itself was that FTS answered in April of 2016, and within 3 months of filing an answer, the Rule 11 motion had been filed, and it was on the heels of the deposition testimony that was given, and the fact that FTS was now moving for summary judgment, God bless you, on the record as it existed at that point. And so this was not an instance in which FTS was lying in wait to file the Rule 11 motion. There was also a couple mediations that happened in the case. Again, Rule 11 motions are, as Judge Jordan noted, serious charges to bring and also costly in themselves in order to bring. We think here that the district court appropriately applied its discretion when it found that the motion was timely filed, that the claim that was asserted here, the single claim, was objectively frivolous, and that counsel should have been aware of the frivolous nature of the claim, and that in setting the award as it did, it was a proper and appropriate amount to set because all of the fees that FTS incurred as a result of defending the action were incurred because of the lack of an investigation at the beginning of this lawsuit. The district court took into account in setting that amount the fees expended by FTS and also removed the fees that should not have been included in the request.
The motion could have been denied solely on that ground, right? That you failed to substantiate what sort of hours you logged in response to the allegedly frivolous allegation.
Under the broad discretion that district courts have in evaluating motions for sanctions, the district court, any party appealing on an abuse of discretion standard would have a high bar. So yes, the district court in evaluating the record and the way the proceedings were before it could have denied that motion. The district court in evaluating the records, however, has the discretion under this court standards in Laranger and the Bivens case that rather than going through and evaluating line by line and looking through things, the court can set a lump sum award and make lump sum reductions based on the size of the fee request that it's made. The district court explained why it was removing, as Judge Jordan raised, why it was removing certain portions of the fee request in setting the amount that it did. If there are no other questions from the panel, I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Christman. Mr. Zeidel.
In brief reply to opposing counsel, there have been many, many cases, and an extreme example is a case where somebody's only paid cash for years, and there are no records. Why would an attorney doing these kind of cases send out a pre-suit letter to ask for records when there are none? That is equivalent to what happened in this case. There was no duty for us to send out a pre-suit letter, and we've briefed that. If this panel creates a duty, then obviously it will be followed. But for a magistrate to come and say that her gripe was that we did not amend this complaint, and that the whole case was not frivolous. That is her finding. She could not find that the statement of claim was frivolous on this record.
My concern is not with that, and I think you have good reasons to not require that sort of absolute pre-suit demand for documents from a defendant in an FLSA case. I think it's probably more of a case-by-case scenario. But my concern remains whether or not after Mr. Estrada was deposed, you had an obligation to take some action to do something, whether it's amendment or a withdrawal through a letter or something else about his claim that he was never paid any overtime. Mr. Christman says that if you look at Mr. Estrada's testimony at his deposition, it was much more equivocal than you say it was, and that he admitted much more than you think he did.
Judge Jordan, with our type of plaintiffs that we represent, thousands over the years, I mean, Estrada's deposition, I'm not going to say that it was typical, but it certainly wasn't extraordinarily ambiguous to where we felt that we had to do that. And that was at a time, once again, past the amendment deadline. This district judge would not have found good cause for us to amend. I can tell you that based on other cases, and that was my perception at the time, and it still is. There was nothing we could do. This is under Rule 11. They didn't move under the court's inherent authority or 1927. They moved specifically under Rule 11 that requires them to give us notice at a time that we can still correct if necessary. They didn't do that. And they say, I mean, their reasons for waiting have changed throughout the pleadings. Their counsel in the court below says that her reason was that she wanted to make sure that the plaintiff signed his pay stubs and his timesheets. Well, they knew that because they made the direct deposit for him. So they knew that he cashed his checks. Opposing counsel says something different on appeal, that they wanted to see if Estrada had any additional documents to offer at the time of his deposition. Either way, why didn't they send us the Rule 11 letter when they gave us all the documents at the beginning of the case? If this case was so plainly frivolous that those documents were the open and the shut, that was the hatchet that they were waiting for, why not send the letter? They don't have to file the motion. Send the letter like they're supposed to. Give us time. That's the point of Rule 11. And Rule 11 requires, as per the rule, that the specific conduct be illuminated so that opposing counsel has time to do something. A reading of their Rule 11 motion doesn't do that. It contains an extraneous Florida statute. It claims that we were claiming time and a half as opposed to halftime, which isn't true. We've always claimed this is a halftime case because that's as much as the plaintiff would be allowed under 778.12. The motion itself was defective. It was too late. And we understand that abuse of discretion is a wide, wide standard, but it must have its limitations. I mean, if there's a mistake that the magistrate made based on the law or on the facts, a clear abuse of discretion, then we think that this is the typical case where there should be a reversal. I mean, yes, we acknowledge the broad standard, but this case just exhibits a magistrate that went out of her way to hammer us with a $60,000 sanction based on prior cases, one of them that's been overturned by this court in a published decision, the Silva case. She didn't take into consideration that the Daily Business Review has already published this article on this particular sanction award, which is a gift that keeps giving and giving and giving, even until the present day, as per opposing counsel, constantly littering the docket and throwing that in our face. So for this type of a, if there was a violation, which we ask that you not find, but if there was, $60,000 is just way, way out of course, especially for billing records that the magistrate says that she has a real problem determining any specificity from, because they didn't even follow her orders by parsing out what they should have, but yet she still unearthed $60,000. So we ask for a reversal, and we certainly thank you for listening to us on this case.
All right, thank you both very much. Okay.